This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello. Welcome to Night Transmissions number 128. I'm Gary Clinton, and I'm about the closest thing you're going to get to a host for this show. Kind of sorry about that. I know you deserve better, but you're going to have to suffer along with me. Speaking of suffering, our first show, that may have come out wrong. I don't really mean there's suffering involved in listening to this first program. The suffering is entirely on the part of the characters. Anyway, this is from The Crime Club. This was produced and directed by Willis Cooper of Lights Out in Quiet Please fame. And it was a series that ran for about a year, spanning 1946 and 1947. That makes it sound like 2 years, doesn't it? But it wasn't. It ran part of 1946 and part of 1947. There was an imprint of books published by Doubleday called The Crime Club, which had a long and illustrious history. It began in 1948. I meant to say 1928. And we continued to publish until 1991. Along the way, publishing some absolute classics and introducing a number of mystery writers to the American public. All right, there actually exists no evidence of any kind of contractual arrangement between the Mutual Network and Doubleday Publishing. But really, even the most casual exploration of the titles in this series, well, it becomes clear that the literary series is the inspiration, as most, but not all, of the stories told here were adaptations of the Doubleday series. This is a pretty good series, although it does occasionally suffer from an excess of ambition. And like today's show, sometimes when you take a full-blown novel and condense it down to 25 minutes, like, it got to leave some stuff out. And sometimes the shortcut affects the pacing and the ending of a story. And in this particular case, I certainly felt that the ending feels more than a bit rushed. It's like, oh my God, we're at 25 minutes, we gotta wrap this thing up, folks. And so they wrapped it up. You'll be the judge. From April the 3rd of 1947, the sun is the witness.
Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Yes, this is the Crime Club. I'm the librarian. The sun is a witness. Yes, we have that Crime Club story for you. Come right over. Take the easy chair by the window. Comfortable? The book is on this shelf. Here it is. The Sun is a Witness by Aaron Mark Stein. A very unusual story of a design for killing that couldn't succeed without murder. Let's look at it under the reading lamp. It was Tim Mulligan's job as an archaeologist to find out about dead civilizations. And he was finding out about the Anasazi, the Indian cliff dwellers who inhabited the great canyon walls of the Southwest many centuries ago. It was late morning, June 22nd, the second day of summer, and Tim Mulligan was digging carefully in one of the caves high above the canyon floor when George Dillon, the owner of the property and Tim's benefactor, climbed slowly up from the camp cave 30 feet below. He stopped to catch his breath.
George, What are you doing up here?
I wanted to see how you're getting along, Jim.
You shouldn't have done it. You're hurt. Where's Tony Blake?
He's around somewhere. You're not going to snitch on me, are you, boy?
You're his responsibility, Pop. He's your doctor.
Yes, but he didn't join the outfit so he can take care of me.
What do you mean?
He wants me to take care of him.
Oh, that.
Yeah. And maybe I will, after he and my niece Marion get married. But right now, it's Indian history that's got all my attention.
Oh, yeah. Well, I dug up a grave, George.
Anastasi?
I think so. I haven't unwrapped the mummy yet.
Good. We can do that together. Come on, let's go.
Hmm.
What's that?
The wind.
No, Tim. No wind ever made a sound like that. Sounds human. It is human. And it's coming from...
George, take it easy.
It's the cave.
There's no one in there.
The open grave. The Anasazi mummy. Tim.
This has got to be a trick.
Tim.
George.
My heart.
Where's the digitalis?
In the... It's all right. I just lost my breath.
Huh?
I'll be all right.
Are you sure?
Yes. Help me down to the camp cave.
You bet. Let me call for Tony first. I feel a lot better with him around. Tony! Tony Blake! I guess he's out of range. Let's go. How is he, Tony?
He just fell asleep.
Hmm?
Let's get away from this cave opening. I don't want him disturbed.
Okay.
Now, what about that goose, Tim?
Somebody's trying to kill your patient, Doctor.
Hmm?
Do you think he can be scared to death?
With his heart, anything can happen.
That's what I mean. Where's Marion?
Are you kidding?
Not this trip. You, Marion, and I are the only ones here with George. The others...
Well, that's where she went, to the others at the ranch house.
When?
This morning, while you were digging for your ghost. She was worried about her brother.
Oh, of course. It's been 4 days since Fraser went back to the house with Matt Casey to get provisions. I didn't realize...
Now, look, Tim, I got to talk to you about something.
Yeah?
Give up this crazy project.
Give it up?
It's not doing George any good. His heart can't take it.
I'm not his doctor, Tony.
And I am. So, what, he won't listen to me. As long as you're on the job, he wants to be with you. Don't you understand?
Yes, I think I do.
He's a fibrillator heart in a very bad shape, and the slightest stimulation...
You're not worried about that, Tony, are you?
What?
You've got an axe of your own to grind, and it's beginning to look like a battle axe.
Don't get dirty, Mulligan.
I'll try not to. You can't cut me out, so you're trying to move me out. Anything to get George's mind off Indians and out of your sanitarium project.
The darn sight more useful than digging for dried up bones.
That depends on how much of a scientist you are.
I told you not to get dirty, Mulligan.
Stop waving those fists. You're liable to hit yourself in the face.
Tim! Tony!
George!
Come in here, both of you.
I thought you were sleeping.
I heard every word you two said out there. When do you think I'm going to die, Tony?
If you continue to stay here, George...
I'm going to stay here until Timothy finishes what he's doing.
Then there's no telling. There's nothing I can do about it.
Are you quitting?
No, I'll be around if you need me.
You shouldn't have been so rough with him, Pop.
Tim.
Yeah, what, George?
Tim, do you really think somebody's trying to scare me to death?
It's possible.
Hmm. That fellow?
I don't know. I'd rather not believe your own doctor's out to kill you.
He's the only one here with us, Tim. And if that sound we heard was not a ghost, but...
What's
a... Travis Nick.
Where?
In here someplace.
Now, stay where you are, George, and don't get excited. I'll look for it.
Wait.
Try not to get excited, George, and don't get off that cot.
You'll never find it, Tim.
It's in this cave, I will.
It isn't.
What?
It's in this wall next to me. Solid rock. And we can hear the rattle.
Oh, wait a minute, George.
I don't want to believe in ghosts, but nobody can make that sound come out of solid rock.
Oh, wait. All right, Pop, it's gone. We can relax. Yeah, Tony's right. This is a bad place for you.
I'm not afraid, Timothy.
But I am. I'd like to get you back to the ranch house where you might get an even break.
I'm not running away.
Good for you. I'm taking you away. Now, sit tight. I'll get Tony and we'll load the stuff into the car.
Tim, does that mean you're... giving up your work here?
No, indeed, Pop. It means I'm going into another business, ghost hunting.
Well, George, as soon as we get to the ranch house, you start taking things easy.
I'll do nothing of the kind, Tony. Say, Tim.
No?
How soon do you expect to go back to the camp?
Right after we get you set.
Good. I'll get Matt Casey to go back with you. He knows every inch of that canyon. And if someone's out there playing ghost... Or was.
Don't be surprised if it was one of the Indians from the reservation.
Is that your theory, Tony?
They're very superstitious about their dead being dug up, Tim. Especially if they're going to be used as museum pieces.
That's enough of that. Slow down. There's the ranch house.
Oh, say, there's Fraser walking away from his car. Honk the horn, Tony.
Well, look who's here. You must have come out just behind me.
Is the expedition over?
Temporarily.
Give us a hand with the luggage, Fraser.
For your Uncle George, anything. Where's the rest of the party?
Well, what do you mean?
Matt Casey and Marion, of course. Are you trying to kid me?
Well, aren't they here?
No. Some joke, huh?
Fraser, Marion left this camp this morning. She was coming to see how you and Matt were getting along.
Matt and I? But Matt went back to camp 2 days ago. He took a truckload of provisions.
Are you sure?
Now look, Tim, I was here when he left.
You smell as though you might be foggy about things.
I've had a few drinks, but I know what I'm talking about. I pick up the stuff in town, and Matt took it from here.
Why didn't you come back with him, Fraser?
I took a liking to civilization, Uncle George. So after Matt bounced off, I bounced back to town where the civilization is beautiful and lively. I got back a few minutes ago.
You were there for 2 whole days?
I couldn't help it. The attraction was magnetic.
Can it be proved, Fraser?
Don't be a comedian, Tim. What's mine is mine.
What about Marion?
I don't know, Tony. Sis might have been here. Say, maybe she hit for town.
For some lively civilization?
What does that mean, Mulligan?
Nothing personal, Dr. Blake. Why don't you take care of your patient while I go back to the camp to find out if the spirit is still functioning?
Hello?
Hello?
Anybody here?
Anybody here?
Oh, Tim.
Hello, Mary.
Where is everybody? Why didn't you answer me?
One question at a time, please.
I've been running around in circles all day. First the ranch house, nobody there. Then back to this.
I'm a little winded. Just give me time.
Where is everybody?
Everybody but Matt Casey is at the ranch house.
Why?
They gave up the ghost.
Huh?
What are you doing up here on top of the canyon wall?
Oh, this is going to be a national park someday.
Uh-huh.
Monument to Indian culture. Don't you feel proud of what Uncle George is going to do?
I didn't see your car below, Marion.
Always stick to the subject. You can't lose that way. My car isn't parked in the canyon. I came up the back way for a change.
Mm-hmm. Bet you had a very good reason, too.
Perfect. I got tired of the canyon road.
Of course.
Matt Casey must have had the same feeling about it.
What?
Well, look down there where my car is parked. His truck's there, too.
So?
Yes, and it's loaded to the hilt with provisions. I call that being very ruthless.
Yeah.
All that good food left down there to spoil. I'm starving.
Well, at least you've got a doctor who can feed you vitamins.
Funny man.
Unless you're a ghost and you don't need vitamins.
What does that mean?
Haunt me and find out.
Are you crazy?
Try it. Say, ahai, ahai. Come on, say it in a very deep voice.
You are crazy.
As deep as you can make it. Ahai, ahai.
Yeah, I've always wondered about you archaeologists. Excuse me, I have a date with a mummy.
Wait a minute.
Now listen, you...
Look.
What?
Lying under that rock.
I don't... You must be seeing things.
Yes, everything. And it's only the tail of a rattlesnake.
Why, how wonderful. Another item for your collection?
Would you mind if I picked it up?
I wouldn't mind if you wore it on your nose.
Thanks, I didn't know you cared. See? It still rattles.
Yeah, I know something else that rattles. What was that?
The ghost. I shook this rattle close to the rock and... Yes, all I've got to do is get this rock out of the way like this. Now?
What's happening there?
A perfect chimney right through the canyon wall. Would you like to make a voice test, Marion?
Me? No, thank you. I don't like to hear myself talk.
Not even in the interest of science?
Goodbye, Tim. I'm going home.
Oh, wait. I'm going with you. There's so much I'd like to tell your uncle about a hole in the ground.
Crazy! Uncle George, say, you had quite an experience up at the camp. Tony was just telling me about the ghost.
Yes, and it's occurred to me with Matt Casey missing...
Oh, he wouldn't try to kill me, Dr. Blake.
I didn't say that he would, George.
He's been working for me for 27 years. We're old friends. Fraser, I want you to organize a searching party for Matt.
All right, but if you ask me, he's going on a bender.
I don't think so.
He's done it before. Why, there were times when he'd bust out for a whole week.
He never did it when he had a special job to do. He knew we were waiting for those provisions at the camp.
Yes, that's right, Fraser.
Yes. He knew that I was waiting for something else that was much more important to me.
Something else?
Yes. Well, you might as well know about it now, Fraser. You too, Tony. I sent Matt Casey back here to type up a new will.
Oh?
Yep, I've decided to give all this property to the government for a national park.
Well, that's nothing new, if that's all you've decided.
That's all, Fraser. The rest of my property and all my cash go to you and Marion.
Uncle George.
Yeah?
Nothing, you're just a swell guy. I'd better go out and organize that searching party.
Yeah. And as for you, Tony?
No sanitarium, huh?
Yeah, that's up to Marion. If she wants to set one up for you after I'm dead, she can do it, with my blessing.
Marion, still puzzles me.
Oh, please, Tim, I'm tired of you being puzzled.
Why did Matt Casey use this road instead of the canyon road?
Why, as an archaeologist?
Would he have any reason for wanting to be heard but not seen?
Dear.
Would you have any reason?
Excuse me. The company I keep.
All right, Marion, you don't have to talk to me. I don't wear a badge.
You don't know how pretty that makes you look.
Yeah, I think I do. By the way, why don't you and Tony get married?
There's no hurry.
He's broke, isn't he?
Da-da-dee,
and a big sanitarium with his name all over it could solve an ugly problem.
Uncle George is Tony's patient.
By design.
What do you mean by that?
You brought Tony out here.
Well, suppose I did. That doesn't mean... Now, look here, Mr. Mulligan. I don't like your insinuations.
So there's one thing about the Great Southwest that always fascinates me.
Don't change the subject.
Buzzards.
What?
Over there on that pile of rocks.
Well, you're not stopping, are you?
Of course. Where there are buzzards, there's death. Where there's death, I'm an archaeologist, remember?
Oh, don't be ridiculous. I want to get back to the ranch house.
You will. I'll just take the ignition key out to make sure you don't do it without me. Would you like to join this expedition?
No.
Oh, that's too bad. You don't know how cultural those things can... Marion.
What is it, a pioneer?
There's a body under those rocks. A human body.
What? Timothy Mulligan, if you're kidding
me... Just a hand showing. Part of an arm.
Good heavens.
Looks like a man's.
He must have been caught in a rock fall. Let's dig him out. He might still be alive.
No, no, not with rigor mortis, Marion.
Oh.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious. His fingers. All right, Marion, we better start digging. It's going to take a little time. This one last rock. Now, come on, heave. Don't relax. Keep going. Come on.
What was that?
Oh, we'll look later. Let's get this rock off first.
Can you sit down, Tim?
Yeah. Maybe you'd better go back to the car.
All right. What'd you pick up?
This roll of film must have been spread out under part of that rock. What? Maybe when the pile hit him, it bounced out of his pocket.
Oh, you.
And when we moved that rock, it snapped back on the roll.
You would think that important, wouldn't you? What's a dead body to you?
I'm sorry, Marion, but there's nothing we can do for Matt Casey except turn him over, face up.
No.
Things I don't understand about this.
But...
Matt being here, his truck 2 miles up the road, and an old hand like Matt being caught in a rock fall. What was he doing in this cave? Marion, Matt, don't look. Marion, for Pete's sake, get a grip on yourself. Here, let me take you back to the car.
Leave me alone, you leave me alone.
Now, please, listen to me.
I've known him practically all my life. He was my uncle's oldest friend.
And listen to me in trying to understand what I'm saying.
How are we going to tell Uncle George about this?
Marion. It was no accident. Matt was not killed by a rock fall.
What? What'd you say?
He was murdered.
Tim, I've had enough of you.
Now, listen. Matt was clubbed to death and brought here.
I don't want to hear anymore.
Then look. He was lying in the sand, face down. His face was covered with blood. Dried blood. But the sand is clean. You see what I mean?
Please, take me back to the ranch house. I'm afraid I'm going to be very sick.
Is that you, Fraser?
No, George. It's Marion and Tim.
Marion, Marion, darling, where have you been?
Now, Tony, we've got to talk to Uncle George.
What's the matter?
I thought it might be Fraser. He went out to organize a searching party for Matt Casey.
Oh, well...
What is it, Marion?
Tim, maybe you better do the talking. I don't feel up to it.
What's wrong? Where's Matt?
I'll tell you, George, but I want you to sit down. Take it easy.
I'll do nothing of the kind. Where's Matt?
I say nothing until you sit down.
He's dead, isn't he? Oh, my Lord. Matt.
Tony, it's all right, Tim. I'll know what to do.
Where'd you find him?
Under a rockfall on the county road.
Matt? Under a rockfall? Did you bring him back with you?
No.
We left him there. We'll have to notify the sheriff.
Sheriff?
He was murdered, Uncle George. All the evidence is there. We didn't want to disturb a thing.
Murdered? Matt, what the...
Where's... In the bottle in the dresser in George's room, quick. Marion, get me a glass of water and a spoon. George. George is going to be all right. He'll be all right. Can you hear, George?
Tim, Marion. Here, Tony. Anything I can do?
Yes, get Marion to hurry with that water.
Marion!
Oh, yes, the cupboard door was stuck. I couldn't get
it. Give me that spoon. It's the worst attack I've ever seen have. Now, if I could get him to swallow this stuff...
Oh, he's spitting it out.
Quick, you've got to get it down. Marion, hold his head back.
No, I can't.
Hold it back, I tell you. Now, Tim, I want you to force his jaws apart. I'll keep his mouth open. Got to get this stuff down. There's no time to lose. That's done. Now, I'll make sure. The water will force you. Push it down. There. Now, let him relax. Here, Tim, take this bottle. I'm going to check his pulse.
What's wrong? But the digital talus isn't working.
There,
Tim. Never acted like that after taking a minute. George! Uncle George, please!
It's all over, Marion. He's dead.
I didn't think, Tony. I just fought without thinking.
Marion, there's no use blaming yourself anymore. It was bound to happen sooner or later.
I didn't have to throw it at him. I didn't have to yell murder.
Now, here. There you are. Take this pill.
What is it?
A sedative.
No,
Come on, be good to yourself. You'll sleep for a few hours.
Who's that?
I don't know. Now, look, dear, you're as jumpy as a bee. Now, take this.
Tony.
Fraser.
Come outside for a few minutes. I want to talk to you.
All right.
Hey, what's the matter with you, Marion? You've been crying.
Uncle George is dead.
What?
He had a heart attack. And it was my fault.
Oh, no. Dead.
Tim and I found Matt Casey's body under a rock wall on the county road. It looked like murder, and I... Like a stupid, hysterical fool. Like I couldn't keep it to myself.
I wasn't going to tell him. I was going to let you, Tony, break it to him easy.
What do you mean?
Well, we found Matt's body. It was wrapped up in a blanket. I guess Tim must have done that to keep the buzzards off.
But did you tell the sheriff?
No, a couple of the men took the body to the mortician in town. We thought... Tony, how quick did he go? Uncle George?
Too quick, Fraser. Even the digitalis couldn't help him.
It couldn't help
him? Nothing could, Fraser, when it's not used.
Oh, what do you mean, Tim?
Here's the bottle with a digitalis label on it. I want you to taste its contents, Dr. Blake.
What are you trying to say?
I'm not trying. Go ahead, taste it.
I put that label on there myself.
I'm sure you did. And I'm sure you meant to do the right thing. Well, what's it taste like?
Quinidine sulfate.
Yes, that's what I thought. A powerful heart stimulant. When that gets into a fibrillator heart, it becomes a killer.
Tim!
I'm afraid so, Marion.
No, Uncle George was not murdered. I'll never believe it.
That bottle proves it, whether you believe it or not. How about it, Tony?
I don't understand.
Did you have quinidine sulfate in your collection of bottles?
Yes, but that doesn't mean that I... Now, look here, Tim. I'm the only doctor for miles around. I keep a lot of medicines for emergency purposes.
Of course,
Can't ahead. You two fight this out some other time and some other
now,
place?
Now, wait a minute, Fraser.
I don't want any more talk. Not right now, anyway.
Okay. I'll say no more. Until the sheriff gets here.
I'll send for him myself.
Good.
Later. I think Marion and I should have some time to ourselves, don't you? Before Uncle George becomes Exhibit A.
Well, that's your privilege. Well, if anyone should want me, I'll be in my room, wondering about things. Oh, hello, Marion.
You've been in here so long, I thought you'd died.
Such luck.
What are you doing?
I'm developing.
What?
Not my muscles, honey.
Not your personality, either.
Touché. Did Fraser send for the sheriff?
I don't know. He's been hibernating in the study all afternoon. Now, look, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
I'm ready to believe a lot of things you've said about murder.
That's so kind of you.
But is it going to do anybody any good to make a fuss about it?
Won't do the killer any good.
Be reasonable. Fraser and I are very rich now. And I'm very much in love with Tony.
I'm a stubborn cuss, Marion, when I'm right. And you haven't got enough money to make me think wrong.
How much do you want?
Nothing. Excuse me, Marion. I want to switch on the lights.
Suppose I were to kill you.
Huh? Well, in that case, I'd be dead.
No one would ever know. Fraser and Tony wouldn't tell. Think about it, Tim.
This is the stuff. Here, Mary.
You'll disappear. It can be done, Timothy. There's a lot of open land out here. Places people don't go to.
Think of the place you'd go to, Marion. Mayor, I want to show you something.
Tim!
Now listen, Marion. I've got a lot of friends in New York, and they know where I am. And if they don't hear from me, they're going to wonder and ask a lot of questions. So put down that gun and come over here.
I'm not interested in a strip of film.
But you should be. This is the film we found next to Matt's body. And it tells an amazing story.
What?
Yeah. Do you see those four dark streaks on the negative?
Well, what about them?
Now, they all start at one point and then spread like a fan. The first one is short, second one's a little longer, the third one is the longest, and the fourth one is shorter.
So, what does it prove?
It proves, Marion, that the sun is a witness. And right here on this negative, it's pointing four fingers at a murderer.
What?
Now, stop that gun.
Oh, no.
Yeah. A twist of the wrist and we're equals again. Shall we go now? I'd like to see the other members of your family, present and future.
You'll never convince me, Mulligan, that four streaks on a negative mean murder.
How about letting me try, Tony?
You also said, Tim, that you know who killed Matt Casey.
Oh, I did say that, didn't I, Fraser?
Yes.
I'll go a step further. The person who killed Matt also killed George.
I've had enough of this. I want you to get out of here, Tim.
In time. But whether you listen to me or not doesn't matter. I know you'll listen to the sheriff.
All right, Tim. Prove your sunstreak theory.
Thank you, Doctor. Well, Marion and I found this film next to Matt's body. He was lying at the entrance to a cave, and the rocks were piled high.
So?
No sun or light flooded that cave. The film wasn't ruined, but somehow one ray of sun got through between the rocks and left these marks on the film.
But where's the murderer, Tim?
In this room, Fraser. Today's the 22nd of June. Yesterday was the first day of summer, the longest day of the year. Do you see now what these streaks mean?
That's still a lot of nonsense.
The day before yesterday was shorter, and the day before that still shorter. The position of the sun changes every day. As the days get longer, the sun rises higher. Anybody want to question that fact?
Oh, I see what you mean, Tim. According to that evidence, Matt was killed 4 days ago.
Yes, Tony. He didn't return to camp 2 days ago, as Fraser told us.
Fraser!
Oh, what's the use? It was going to be found out sooner or later. Nobody believed Tony would deliberately give Uncle George the wrong medicine.
Fraser!
I didn't plan it that way when I started. I was going to frighten him to death, but it didn't work, so I came back here and switched labels on the bottles. The medicines looked alike, the same color. I would have done anything then to get Uncle George out of the way.
Why, Fraser?
Well, up at the camp, I overheard him talking to Matt Casey about a new will.
Yes?
I didn't know what was going into it, but I was sure he was going to cut me out. He didn't like some of the people I'd been fooling around with in town.
So you killed Matt Casey to keep him from bringing back the new will?
Yes, but if I'd only read the thing before I burned it, Uncle George would be alive now. I'd have known. Lord, help me. I'd have known.
That's right, Tim. George told us. This whole estate goes to Marion and Fraser except this property.
Yes, the National Park. Fraser, why didn't you fix those bottles after you switched them?
I'd have known. He told me and I'd forgotten what I'd done. I was too happy. Too happy.
And so closes tonight's Crime Club book, The Sun is a Witness, based on a story by Aaron Mark Stein. Stedman Coles did the radio adaptation. Roger Bauer produced and directed. Raymond Edward Johnson played Tim Mulligan. And Sidney Smith was Tony Blake. Oh, I beg your pardon. Hello. I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Yes, this is the Crime Club. I'm the librarian. And we'll look for you next week.
Yeah, okay. This is the first break for today. I know, you don't need them. But I need them. I guess. Just a little while ago, I was whining about the adaptation of novels, a long form, to radio drama, generally a short form, and how this can sometimes lead to considerable dissatisfaction on, well, my part at least. Now, NBC Short Story is a series that does provide the kind of evidence I'm talking about, and what I think they should have done more of. It shows how compatible the short story is with the half-hour anthology format so common in radio. It utilizes the short stories of many of the best writers of the era. Hemingway, Steinbeck, Faulkner, many others. Among the others, and very high on that list, would be Shirley Jackson. And her, I think it was right around 5,000-word story, The Lottery. This is a justifiably famous story, which takes place in a small town, and really is about how we too often assume an attitude of unquestioned obedience to tradition, which can often cause us to tolerate as being very pedestrian, deep evil. I think Shirley Jackson was talking about how this unquestioned obedience is one of the roots of human nature itself. And it just ain't good for us. NBC Short Stories, by the way, wasn't a big success. It only had one season, and that was in 1951. This particular episode is from March the 14th of that year. Probably I should admit here, before you start listening to this thing, that the audio quality is not great. Usually when I admit that the audio quality is not great, I hasten to admit that I think it's listenable. Well, I think it's listenable. I just wanted to put this story out there for you. You see, Shirley Jackson is one of my all-time favorite authors. Seems like I say that a lot, doesn't it? One of my all-time favorite authors. Well, I do enjoy reading, and I do enjoy works that border a little bit on the fantastic. Okay, maybe a lot on the fantastic. And Shirley Jackson was fantastic. She is the only writer who ever actually scared me as I read one of her books, The Haunting of Hill House, which also made a fairly admirable movie, which was directed by Robert Wise in 1963. It starred Julie Harris and Claire Bloom, and is considered a classic of the haunted house genre. That was a remake in, well, it says 1999 here on the internet, but I never saw that one and have no idea about its quality.
NBC presents Short Story. Tonight, Shirley Jackson. She's novelist and short story writer, master of the sunny mood that turns to terror in a single sentence. But her statements are not dark for the sake of darkness, rather for the bitter truth that's in them. Shirley Jackson. Tonight, one of the most dramatic and horrifying of the Shirley Jackson stories, The Lottery.
Floyd. Why did some of you get up out of that bed?
Oh, it ain't 7 yet.
Of course it ain't. Now you get up, you hear? It's lottery day. Now, Dickie. You eat your cereal.
I don't want no more, Ma.
You eat up your cereal, because you ain't going to have nothing but sandwiches till supper time.
Sandwiches?
You heard me. I'm not going to cook no three hot meals on lottery day.
All right, Davy, that's enough for the chickens.
Shoot. Hey, Ross, shoot.
Come on out, son. We got a fork hay down for the cows. We won't be back all day.
Ma coming, too? Just like Sunday for sure?
Yeah, that's right. All folks in the town line will be in today for the lottery.
I can't find my collar stud. Who took my collar stud?
Just don't fret, grandsire. It's around here somewhere.
Now, if I can't find my collar stud, I ain't going. 77 lotteries I've been to and never missed a one. Larry, you find my collar stud, you hear?
The morning of June 27th was clear and sunny with the fresh warmth of a full summer day. The flowers were blossoming, and the grass on the town green in front of the bandstand was a nice warm summer green. The folks in the village and the farmers inside the township line began to gather in the square between the post office and the bank by about 10 o'clock. School was out for the summer, and the kids came in early to chase around the board sidewalks the way kids will. Bobby Martin and Harry Jones were sitting in front of the post office swapping stones. Bobby had his pockets full already. Nice, smooth, round ones. The girls stood aside, talking among themselves and looking over their shoulders at the boys. And the very small children rolled in the dust or clung to the hands of their older brothers and sisters.
Morning, John.
Morning, Mr. Summers.
Yeah, nice day for the lottery, ain't it?
Yes.
Had rain yesterday up to the North Village. They got to start the lottery a day ahead to get done. 200 families.
That's right.
Yeah. Got to hustle to get the lottery over with up there. Won't take us more than maybe a couple hours.
It seems longer.
Yeah, that's the way it is with the lottery. I was talking it over with Mrs. Summers. It's a suspense makes time go slow.
Not slow enough.
You draw this year, don't you?
I guess so.
Yeah, that's the rule, all right. Stranger in town draws his second year.
Morning, Mr. Summers. John?
Morning, Miss Delacroix. In early, I see.
Well, I don't get up to the village often. George don't like to leave the stock. You going to have the store open after?
Most likely. It didn't used to be done.
Well, you got to be modern, I always say. Excuse me, won't you? Martin's has just got in. It's a nice day for it, though. You can say that for fair.
Why don't you go faster, Pa? We'll miss everything.
Oh, don't worry, Davey. We'll get there in plenty of time.
I want to go into Summer's store after to get some patterns. Elsie Dunbar told me he's got some new ones in for short-waisted figures.
Let's not talk about it, Elsie.
What do you mean? I've got that flowered stuff left over from last year. If I can get a good pattern.
I don't want to talk about after.
Oh.
Come on, Pa. Can't we go a little faster?
All right. Up there. Get up. Fiddler. I was talking to John Gunderson.
The school teacher?
Mm-hmm. He's got to draw this year.
It's only right. Second year in town.
I told him I was thinking of packing and moving out.
Bill Hutchinson, you crazy?
I told him I was going to pack the wagon and tie the stock onto the end of it and just move out.
You mean just leave the farm?
That's right. I was going to do it before lottery day this year.
That's crazy, Bill. Where would you settle? Well, your folks have farmed that ground since heaven knows when.
Yeah, I know. I was going to just move out. It's too late now.
Oh, Bill, you talk the same way every year. No sense to it.
No, there's no sense to it.
A woman sees things like this clearer. You just don't think about it, that's all. You come in for the lottery, then go to Summers and buy something nice. Talk to folks. Why don't you look at it that way, Bill?
I suppose you're right. School teacher agreed with me, though. Go on, get over there.
Well, that's the way, Pa. Hurry up, we'll miss all the fun.
Soon the men began to gather, standing around smoking and looking at the kids. Talking about planting, grain, tractors, taxes, you know. Dickie Delacroix and a couple of kids had made a great big pile of stones in one corner of the square, and they were playing King of the Hill on it. The men stood together away from the pile of stones watching. Their jokes were quiet, and they smiled rather than laughed.
They're nice-looking folks, aren't they, John?
Yeah, they're nice.
They don't see them all together except on lottery day. Of course, there's Sunday in church, but some go to the Congregationalist and some to the Baptist, and folks like the Dunbars don't go nowhere.
Morning, Mr. Summers.
Morning, Tessie. I've got those patterns in.
I'll be over right after.
John.
Morning, Bill.
I want to talk to you. Hello, Summers.
Morning. Don't worry about me. I've got to see about the box and all for the drawing.
Oh, morning, Tommy.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, it's the day.
Yeah.
You going to draw?
I've got to. That's the rules.
You said you wouldn't. You sat there in the post office and said you wouldn't.
I know, but I'd have to leave town. It isn't easy to get another school this late.
Well, anyways, you only draw for yourself. Tessie keeps talking about after. Starts me to sweating. She keeps talking about buying a pattern up to the summer store after. Short waisted, she said.
I suppose you get used to it. I suppose if you've always had it, you don't think about it.
I don't. I lived in the village all my life. I don't get used to it.
Can I stay with Dickie Delacroix? Can I stay with him?
No, you got to stay with the family, Davy.
Aw, the other kid's got all the stones. Can I stay with them?
Davy, I said, Davy, come here. Davy! Look at that. He's having fun. All the kids are having fun.
Why?
That's what I want to know. Why?
You're a farmer. You know the answer.
You told me you couldn't find anything in the book says it has to be. It stands to reason you find it in the books, don't it?
This isn't my part of the country, Hutchinson. I don't make the rules.
It don't stand to reason you could try to find out the truth. That's all I say.
You can't argue with the folks about the lottery. I've tried.
No, you can't argue with folks. Well, anyways, it's a nice day for it.
It ain't right. I've been telling them year after year it ain't right.
Now, grandsire, take it
easy. Now, you listen to me, Floyd Summers. I'm the oldest man in the village. 77 years I've been in the lottery. 77 years.
Yeah, I know that, Mr. Warner, but you
But
can't
don't butt me. No, sir, don't butt me. I know what's right about the lottery. It ought to be chips of wood. One chip with the name of every family, all in the big black box.
We can't do it that way, grandsire. You know that. The box ain't big enough.
That's the way it was when I was a boy. Chips of wood. None of this here bitty pieces of paper. Paper, huh? What kind of a lottery do you expect to have with paper?
Well, there's too many folks in the village for wood anymore.
Nobody pays any mind to the old ways. There ought to be marching, too. I remember marching and somebody sort of chanting like. That's what there ought to be on lottery day.
That was a long time ago. Nobody remembers that anymore.
Yeah, that's the trouble. Nobody remembers. Now, you take that black box.
It's cracking. We ought to make a new one.
A new one? Listen to him. A new box. Why, they used that box in my father's time for the lottery. And he told me it's made from the pieces of the box in his grandfather's time. Now, you're supposed to be in charge of that box. Why, I saw it year before last lying in Graves barn. And this year, it sat right on the shelf in your store. Now, is that any way to take care of that box? They don't run the lottery the way they used to. Hey, I've been in it 77 years, and I ought to know.
Tessie, come here.
What? Oh, excuse me, Miss Delacroix.
All right, Tessie.
Tessie.
Now, what is it, Bill?
Where's Davy?
Playing with the other children there by the stones.
Get him over here.
Why?
We're hitching up and getting out.
Oh, we've got to wait for the drawing. We can't go now.
I said we're going now.
Oh, Bill, don't be silly. First place, we came all the way into the village for the lottery. Second place, Summers won't be open till after, and I want to get those patterns.
What? After? Don't you understand? Suppose...
Bill, I'm surprised at you. Why, nobody else acts this way. You've just got to take it as it comes. You're a farmer, you know that.
What's that got to do with it?
Well, you didn't take on when the hog died of cholera before killing time. You just went on.
That's different. It just happened. You can't help it. It won't go.
No, I won't. Neither will you. I don't get into the village often, and lottery day is one time I can see all the other women and talk. I'm not going back till it's all over supper time. My goodness, Bill, you'd think it was something unusual. Lottery comes every year. It always has.
conducted, as were the square dances, a teenage club, and a Halloween program by Mr. Summers, who had time and energy to devote to civic affairs. He was a round-faced, jovial man, and the people were sorry for him because he had no children, and his wife was a scold. He was busy in the middle of the square with a little black box, setting it up and balancing it on a three-legged stool.
One of you folks want to give me a hand with the box? Mr. Martin?
What? What?
Just hold it on the corner, steady.
Watch his hand, Summers.
Now, we're going to do this fair and square, just like always. Now, last night, up at the coal company office, Mr. Graves and I made up the slips of paper.
It ought to be chips of wood. What kind of piddling lottery can you have with...
Now, grandson, don't you interrupt Mr. Summers.
There's a box here. Anybody wants to can haul them out and check them over. Time now for the swearing in. Mr. Graves will administer the oath to me. I expect, as usual, we'll waive election.
There used to be no election. Used to pass from father to son.
All right, all right. You, Floyd Summers, solemnly swear to carry out the duties of this lottery without fear or favor of prejudice, bias, or any other untoward acts of omission or commission, so help you.
I do.
You tell him, Floyd!
Well, I expect now we're ready. We'll proceed as usual, drawn by families, according to the rules.
Wait a minute, Floyd Summers.
Oh, looks like another interruption. Oh, morning, Mrs. Martin.
How do you like that? He forgot what day it was. Hello, Tessie.
Well, how are you?
I thought my old man was out back stacking wood. Then I looked out the window and the kitten was gone, and I remembered it was the 27th and came a-running. Did I miss anything?
Oh, you're in time. They're still talking away up there.
It was just beginning, Mrs. Martin. Now, you just take your place with your family.
My hand's still wet from the dishwater.
Well, now, I guess you better get started. Yeah. Let's get this over with so as you can get back to work. Ain't anybody here? Huh? Well, now, this ain't the drawing. Just checking the list.
Yeah.
Now, Adams? Adams? Well, I'm glad to see you. I missed you last Saturday.
I guess you made it after all, huh, Miss Martin? Well, now, Tessie, between you and me, I knew it was lottery day, but you wouldn't have me leave the dishes in the sink now, would you?
Dunbar? Dunbar?
Dunbar, come on.
Whole drawers for Dunbar. Clyde broke his leg, didn't he? Now, who's drawing for him?
Well, I guess I draw.
Oh, that's right. That's the rule. Wife draws for husband. Captain, you got a grown boy to do it for you, haven't you, Jenny?
Well, Horace is not the 16 yet. Guess I got to fill in for the old man this year.
All right, I got that check. Watson boy drawing this year? Yeah. Oh, there you are, Charlie. Good to see your mother's got a man to do it. I suppose old man Warner's here.
You know darn well I'm here, Floyd Summers. I was just talking to you. I ain't missed the lottery in 77 years.
All right, grandson, I was just joking. Well, that gets the list straight. All the rest is straight families. Unless anybody's got anything to add, we're ready for the drawing. Now then, Adams. Yeah. All right, Steve, just draw anyone. Don't look at it till after. Next, Adamson. Right, that does it. Anderson.
Seems like they changed order, Dawn, don't it, Tessie?
Oh, no, that's the way it's always been.
Seems like there's just no time at all between lotteries anymore. Seems like we got through with the last one only last week. I declare the way time flies.
Time sure goes fast.
Delacroix.
There goes my old man.
Now, don't worry, Agnes.
Dunbar.
Is that you, Janie?
Well, you ladies will excuse me.
Come on, Janie, you're holding us up.
There she goes.
I'm coming.
Well, folks shouldn't hold up the lottery. It takes up a perfectly good morning as it is. Well, last year it didn't get time for half the things the men to do in town.
You're right, Tessie. My old man says he don't like lottery day because I always run the bill up at summer sky high.
Gunderson. John Gunderson.
Oh, there goes the schoolmaster.
I'm not going to draw, Mr. Summers.
He's got to draw.
Now, John, you know the rules. This is your second year in the village.
I know, but I'm not going to draw.
Now, don't be contrary, boy.
Everybody draws in the lottery. What makes you better, schoolmaster?
I don't believe in it.
Now, that isn't the point, John, and you know it.
Listen to him. He don't believe in the lottery. You hear that?
Now, take it easy.
Why, we've always had the lottery. Everybody knows that. Always have and always will.
Over in the North Village, they're talking of giving up the
lottery.
Yeah, a pack of crazy fools in North Village. Listen to this idiot. Nothing's good enough for him. Next thing you know, they'll be wanting to go back to living in caves. Nobody work anymore. Live like that for a while.
They don't have the lottery up where I come from. Stopped it years ago.
Yeah, maybe so, but we ain't fools, not here. Used to be a saying, lottery in June, corn will grow soon. You listen to him with his books and ciphering. First thing you know, we'll all be eating stewed chickweed and acorn.
You're right, Grandpa.
Yeah, sure. There's always been a lottery. Bad enough it ain't what it used to be with Floyd Summers up there joking and all. But there's always been a lottery.
But why? Why? I tell you, they stopped it up north. More villages every year. And the corn grows just as high.
Nothing but trouble in that. Pack of fools.
Now, you ain't no farmer, Gunderson. Old man Warner's right.
Yes, sir.
Lottery in June, corn will grow soon. That's the way it's always been.
You can't get around that, schoolmaster. Lottery in June.
But nobody knows. You've never tried. You just go on and on every year the same way.
We're darn children, and we're going right on just like we always done. What call is a young outsider to talk that way on lottery day? That's what I'd like
now
to know.
Rod,
77 years
but
I've been coming through.
There's no reason for it. No reason. Year after year for generations on June 27th. If you'd only think. If you'd only try. If you were willing to use reason instead of blind obedience to a crazy outworn tradition.
Yeah, that'll be about enough, John. You spoke your piece. Now we better get down to business. Rules say if anybody balks, the committee draws for him. Now, is that right, folks?
Yes, sir. Yes, that's right. Yes, sir.
Now, I'm going to call you again, regular and proper. If you stand mute, we'll go right on and draw for you. Now, which is it?
All right. All right, I'll draw.
Fine. Fine. Now, let's get on. Hutchinson?
Yeah.
Bill Hutchinson?
Get on up there, Bill.
There goes your man, Tessie.
Imagine the schoolmaster making such a fuss. He's no better than the rest if everybody draws on lottery day.
All right, sir. Now the last one. Warner.
Yes, sir. I'm right here.
All right, grandson. Take it easy. It's no rush.
This makes the 77th year I've been in the lottery.
Yes, sir.
77 times.
Draw your slip now.
Yeah.
All right. It's all done. Martin, close the box.
Who's got it? What family?
I ain't got it.
Grandpa, let me see your paper. Let me
you let go of my hand, you hear? I can take care of myself.
Ma, is it us? Is it us, Ma? Well, for goodness sake, what family is it? Who's got it?
All right, folks. Now, let's do this orderly. Now, come on. Now, what family's got the black slip?
It's the Hutchinsons. There. Look, Bill Hutchinson's got it. Yeah, that's right. Aggie, you run tell your father it's the Hutchinsons. Go on, run.
It isn't fair. It isn't fair. Floyd Summers, I saw you. You didn't give him time to take any slip he wanted. I saw you. It wasn't fair.
Now, Tessie, be a good sport.
All of us took the same chance.
It isn't fair, I tell you. It isn't fair.
Shut up, Tessie.
Well, now, everybody, that was done pretty fast. Just 1 hour or 2 minutes. Now, we've got to be hurrying a little more to get done before noon.
It wasn't fair.
Now, Bill, let's see. You draw for the Hutchinson family, don't you? You got any other households in the Hutchinson?
Hey, there's Don and Eva. Make them take their chance. Make them draw.
Now, Tessie, Eva's your daughter, but she's married now. Daughters draw with her husband's families. You know that as well as anyone else.
Oh, sure.
It wasn't fair.
I guess that's it, Joe. My daughter draws with her husband's family. That's only fair.
Well, now, Bill.
I guess there's just us, Floyd. Davy, Tessie, and me.
All right, now. And as far as drawing for families is concerned, it's you. And as far as drawing for households is concerned, that's you, too.
Guess that's right.
Martin, you give me the tickets for the Hutchinsons, all three of them. You got their tickets back?
I got them. In the box, Floyd.
All set, then.
I think we ought to start over.
No, Tessie.
It wasn't fair. You didn't give him time enough to choose. Everybody's all that.
Now, we'll have to get on now. Are you ready,
Bill? Listen, everybody, you got to listen. You can see.
Are you ready, Bill?
Ready.
Davy pick first, then you, then Tessie. Now, you got that? Here, help little Dave.
Davy, come here.
Shepard. It wasn't fair. Miss Delacroix, you can see they didn't give him time.
Now, don't make a fuss, Tessie. It ain't fitting.
All right, now, Bill. You take the slips and keep them folded till everybody picks. Come on, Davy.
Go on, son.
Now, Davy, I want you to pick a piece of paper out of this box and hold tight. You understand?
Sure, Mr. Summers.
All right. Pick now. just one paper, Davy.
I got one.
Good. Now, you better hold it for him, Martin.
All set.
All right, Bill. One paper. That's right. Now, Tessie.
No, it wasn't fair.
Tessie, you've got to draw.
Come on, Tessie.
All right. All right.
I hope it ain't the child. Don't you worry.
It's not the way it used to be. I tell you, there ought to be chips of wood. Lottery ain't like it used to be. People ain't the way they used to be.
Quiet now, folks. Now, let's open the papers. Davy?
Come on, Davy. Open your paper.
There's nothing on it.
Well. Bill?
Mine's blank.
Then I guess it's Tessie.
Oh, no. No.
Show us her paper, Bill. Just the rules.
Tessie, open your hand.
No, no, no.
Come on now. Open your hand.
No, no.
It's Tessie, all right.
Mom, I put up by the pile of stones, all right?
All right, folks, let's finish quickly now.
No, it isn't fair. Oh, Bill, no,
it's too late, Tessie. There's nothing I can do.
Come on, Miss Delacroix, we better get a good stone before they're all gone.
Oh, Dickie will save one for me.
Well, hurry up. She'll be running soon.
It wasn't fair. There wasn't time. Oh, Bill, please, Bill.
You heard him, Tessie. Lottery in June, corn will grow soon.
Mom,
this is so for you.
Come on.
Oh, that's a nice boy, Dickie. What a nice big stone.
You'll have to go ahead and I'll catch up with you. Can't run at all with arthritis in my knees.
All right. There's Davy. Davy, come here.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, here's a little stone for you. Take it.
Sure.
Now, you come along with me, Davy.
Sure, I want Mr. Fun. We've got to run after Ma now, huh?
That's right, Davy. Come on.
Listen, everybody. They didn't give me time. It wasn't fair.
Not everybody. I guess they're helping.
Come on, Davy. Throw your stone. Go on. Throw your stone.
Oh, it isn't fair. It isn't right. Oh, Bill, you can't let them. Not me. It can't be me. Oh, it wasn't fair. They can't do it to me. Agnes, Emily, you can't. You can't really, not me.
Go on, Davy. Now throw your stone.
Oh, no, not the stone. No, it isn't right. Oh, Davy, my own baby. Don't. Don't.
Goods and patterns and notions. The little children played in the dust, throwing pebbles at each other. The lottery was over for this year. Lottery in June, corn will grow soon. Next year. Next June 27th. Well, maybe we'll learn. Maybe there'll be no lottery. Maybe we'll begin to reason, to find the truth. Maybe we'll find out we don't have to pick out folks in the lottery. That's because our fathers and their fathers did it. Because it always was that way. Maybe next year there won't be a lottery. It's up to all of us. Chances are there will be, though.
Lottery by Shirley Jackson, whose novel The Hangsman will be published soon. The adaptation was by Ernest Canoy of NBC. In tonight's cast, Mrs. Summers was Louise Lorimer. Summers was Charles Seale. Mrs. Delacroix was Gail Bonney. Dickie was Johnny McGovern. Hutchinson was Jeff Corey. Davy was Jeffrey Silver. Warner was Stephen Chase. Mrs. Dunbar was Irene Tedrow. The schoolmaster was Jim Musser. Tessie was Margaret Brayton. Graves was Jack Nessel. The folk music was by Morris King. Your announcer, Don Stanley. The director of NBC Presents Short Story is Andrew C. Love. This program came to you from Hollywood. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Lend Uncle Sam a dime to win this war, and he'll pay you back with interest when he's won it. The easiest, most convenient way to lend him these dimes is to enroll in the payroll savings plan. Just tell your boss to deduct 10 cents from every dollar he pays you and lend it to Uncle Sam in your name. Sign up for this simple savings plan today, and when victory comes, you'll have war bonds in your pockets instead of Axis bonds on your wrists.
Okay, we're coming up on an alien world. You see, the next program, Alien Worlds, was an American syndicated radio program that produced only 26 episodes in 1979. The series began its run on January the 7th of 1979 with an excellent soundtrack and good production standards. And it was successful. Don't let the small number of episodes fool you. It would come to play on over 500 radio stations all over the country, and was even more successful internationally once it was picked up in New Zealand and Australia. This episode, Seeds of Time, first aired on April the 8th of 1979, and is a story of how some alien DNA begin to grow at an alarming rate, and of course begin to threaten the existence of our heroes at Star Lab. Don't you hate it when that happens? I certainly do. It's the old story. Pushy alien DNA.
Slowly rotating at the edge of deep space, 1,000 kilometers beyond the atmosphere of 21st century Earth, is the Arthur C. Clarke Astronomical Observatory, Starlab. Here, Starlab Research Director Maura Cassidy and scientists and technicians of the International Space Authority watch over the countless stars and planets that fill the silent distances beyond the giant space station. This week, an ancient intruder from another galaxy exposes Starlab to the genetic mysteries of the Seeds of Time on Alien Worlds. Beyond Starlab, the SET interceptor Solaris reduces speed and moves into a preliminary docking orbit with the huge space station. Aboard the Solaris, Captains John Graydon and Buddy Griff.
Solaris to Starlab Control.
This is Starlab. Go ahead, Solaris.
We're holding at the outer boundary, Jerry. How soon can you get us aboard?
Traffic's pretty heavy right now, John. I've got a Soviet fighter and two Canadian tankers coming in now, and three lunar shuttles in a docking orbit 2 kilometers out. Hold your position. I'll get back to you in about 10 minutes.
Roger, Starlab. Solaris out.
Starlab, clear.
Well, since 10 minutes usually means half an hour, why don't we put the ship on autopilot and go down to the cargo bay for a little zero-gravity racquetball? Do you know where the rackets are? Oh, they're floating around down there somewhere. All right, let's go. What? We better stay, Skip. The high-density scanners are picking up something. How far away? 4.6 kilometers. And it's holding at 081 degrees starboard. Get a full magnification visual and bring it up on screen 6.
Right.
What is it? I don't know. I've never seen anything like it.
In the center of the screen, against a background of jet black space and scattered stars, the mysterious object begins to slowly rotate. Reflected sunlight blazing from each of its 10 smooth surfaces.
Solaris to Starlab.
This is Starlab. Go ahead, Solaris.
Jerry, we're visually monitoring a UFO. Are you picking it up on your scanners?
No, I don't think so. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, there is something out there about 4 kilometers from your present position.
Right. Okay, tell Morrow what the situation is, and you'd better notify Professor Ballin, too. We're going in for a closer look.
I'll keep an eye on you from here, John. Be careful. Starlab out.
What do you think, buddy? Well, let's play it safe and sort of sneak up on it. I'll do a tomography profile at 3 kilometers. If the thing's not dangerous, we can get in close and do a phase one scanner series.
And what if it explodes and blows us to Kingdom Come?
You know, maybe we should stick to racquetball.
Whoa. Talk about sensory overload. Wonder how she keeps her balance. Maybe it's trick photography. Ah, couldn't be. No photographer is that tricky.
Captain Obert of Science, Starlab Control.
This is Starlab. Go ahead, Maggie.
We've got a problem, Jerry. We're still working on this new orbital power satellite at Vector 706, and we just lost our last bundle of solar panels.
What happened?
An anchoring cable on the superstructure let go, and the panels have drifted off into deep space. Can you help us out? This thing's supposed to be operational by tonight.
How many panels do you need?
10.
What type?
Amplitron ST-16.
Oh, hold on. I'll check the computer and see what we got. This is your lucky day, Maggie. We've got 24 SP-16s in storage. Will this be a pickup or a delivery?
I won't be able to spare any of our tugs for another hour or so. What's available on your end?
Well, we've got a Soviet freighter heading your way in about 15 minutes. I'll have the captain contact you, okay?
I'll stand by for his call. Thanks, Jerry. Construction over to 5 now.
Starlab control, clear. Docking Bay 12, this is the bridge.
Bay 12, go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, Ernie, call Storage Bay 19 and tell them to deliver 10 Amplitron SP-16 solar panels to the Odessa, and then have Captain Vashenko contact Construction Orbiter 5. It's kind of an emergency.
Will do, Jerry.
Yeah. Where was I? Right. Sensory overload. Oh, yeah. Wow, look. Oops.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Maura.
You heard from John and Buddy?
Yeah, about 20 minutes ago. They've maneuvered the Solaris into a side-by-side position with the UFO, and Buddy said he'd contact us as soon as he did the preliminary scan series.
Okay. What's that magazine you're holding behind you?
Magazine?
Come on, Jerry, hand it over.
Oh, Maura.
The Astounding Adventures of Galactic Gladys, the Girl Wonder?
Well, you know.
Which one of these bimbos is Galactic Gladys?
I believe that's her there, locked in mortal combat with the evil swamp gas creature.
Well, she's certainly a wonder, all right. I'll bet she hasn't seen her feet in years. Jerry, where did you get this publication?
I found it in the technician's lounge.
Uh-huh. I wondered why they were all running around down there with their tongues hanging out. Jerry.
Hi, Professor Ballin.
How you doing, Jerry?
David, you're just in time for a little X-rated science fiction. Look at this.
What happened to her clothes?
The evil swamp gas creature ate them.
Well, yum, yum.
I don't know about you, David. 3 days on Starlab and you're already starting to sound like Buddy Grip.
It must be the altitude.
Solaris to Starlab Control.
This is Starlab. Go ahead, John.
We finished the preliminary scans on the UFO. Is Mara there?
I'm right here, John, and so is our new alienologist.
Okay, here's Buddy. The object is 3 meters square and shaped like a decahedron. It's made of some kind of copper-colored metal that's about 75% hydrogen. far as we can tell, there's no inboard or outboard propulsion system.
How fast is it moving, Buddy?
How fast do you want it to move?
What does he mean, John?
Well, it was stationary when I brought the ship alongside, but for the past 10 minutes, it's been matching our speed, no matter how fast it goes.
What kind of a readout did you get on the tomography scan, Buddy?
The interior of the thing is filled with some kind of ionized gelatin that converts to nitrogen plasma, and then reconverts to gelatin at 12-second intervals.
Buddy, is it giving off any kind of sound?
Yes, it is. When the gelatin converts to plasma, the object gives off what sounds like accelerated heartbeats. And when the plasma reconverts to gelatin, we hear the heartbeats in reverse.
Returning from a routine patrol aboard the Solaris, SET Captains John Graydon and Buddy Griff encounter an unidentified flying object 50 kilometers beyond Starlab.
The object is 3 meters square and shaped like a decahedron. It's made of some kind of copper-colored metal that's about 75% hydrogen.
As John maneuvers the Solaris into a side-by-side position with the UFO, Buddy continues to analyze the object with the ship's tomography scanners.
The interior of the thing is filled with some kind of ionized gelatin that converts to nitrogen plasma, and then reconverts to gelatin at 12-second intervals.
What do you think, David?
I think we better see about getting that thing into one of the isolated laboratory pods.
Buddy, shoot a magnetic grappler over and see if you can bring it in.
We already tried that, Mora. The grappler pad won't stick. The object is anti-magnetic.
How about if you go EVA and try to push it into the Solaris' cargo bay?
Hold on just a moment, please. I don't think that'll be necessary. From the way it's been matching our speed, I think it'll follow us in.
All right, give it a try. If it works, get the object as close as you can to the outboard airlock of Isolab 9. I'll have a crew standing by to take it inside.
Okay, Mora. Solaris out.
Starlab clear.
Come on, David. Let's get down there.
Fifteen minutes later, the Solaris maneuvers the object into a position 2 meters away from Isolab 9's outboard airlock. Then, as John guides the Solaris into a nearby docking bay, the lab's airlock opens, and a crew of technicians in yellow pressure suits and tinted glass helmets take the alien decahedron inside. 10 minutes later, the object rests on a slowly rotating observation pad in the center of the lab's brightly lit quarantine chamber.
Remarkably beautiful, isn't it?
Frightens me.
Why?
The way it looks. The color and size, texture. All those desperately perfect angles constantly repeating themselves. Its physical aspects are so familiar we can call them by name in a language we all understand. And yet we don't know what it calls itself or what it might be calling us.
You feel whatever's inside is alive?
Don't you?
Yes.
Well, at least our scientific cells are still in sync.
Mara, please. Not now.
Who's here?
Hi, fellas. Well, I'm glad to see it hasn't blown up yet. Come on, Skip, let's go inside for a close-up.
Yeah, okay.
I think you better stay on this side of the glass for a while. The object's still being scanned. If you go in there now, your body impulses will be included in the scanner data.
Maybe we should go in anyway, just to blow their minds up in data processing.
I can hear Professor Clark now.
I say, Ramsey, have you seen this printout? Graydon and Griff are trapped inside that alien gizmo.
Really? How do you know it's them?
Elementary, my dear Ramsey. The tall one's thumbing his nose, and the short one thinks it's funny.
Mara, David, not even a smile. What's with you two?
We've got a lot on our minds, John.
I see. Well, okay. Come on, Skip, let's go have dinner.
Yeah, right.
So we'll see you guys.
See you later.
It's time we had a talk, David. Let's go up to my quarters.
Coming to Star Lab wasn't my idea, Maura. We go where the ISA wants us to go, you know that.
If I'd known you were married, I would have asked Commissioner White to send someone else.
Why?
When I was told you were going to spend 3 months on Star Lab, I thought we were getting a second chance.
Second chance for what, Maura? To pick it up where it fell apart 3 years ago?
Why not?
Because your work has always been more important to you than anything else. And I don't think that'll ever change. Even when things were good, we were never together more than 3 months out of the year. Your whole life was spaceports and laboratories and conferences and trips off the planet.
You make it sound like I didn't care at all.
I don't mean to, Maura. I know you cared. And I know you loved me. But you loved the rockets more.
I'm sorry, David.
So am I. I'll see you in the morning, Maura.
Okay, Lunar Shuttle 10, I have you on the screen. Your docking orbit insertion coordinates are 509er at subvector 70 alpha.
509er at 70 alpha. Roger, Starlab. Lunar Shuttle 10, out.
Starlab control, clear. Morning, Maura.
Jerry, have you seen David?
Not since yesterday afternoon.
Good morning.
Have either of you seen David?
Yeah, we saw him after dinner last night when we went down to have another look at the UFO. He was in the isolab with it. Maybe he's still there.
I checked the isolab 20 minutes ago.
Well, maybe you missed him. Let's get on and take another look. There he is, Maura. Hit the intercom button, Skip.
David, can you come out for a minute?
There's no need to be frightened, Maura. Professor Mallon has not been harmed.
David, what's the matter with you? You sound so...
Maura, his hands are transparent.
David, what happened to your hands?
It's not David.
I am not Professor Mallon, Maura. I am of him. Inside my vehicle.
Well, then open it. Let him out.
As you wish, Maura.
David!
Good God.
Isolab control to sick bay.
Sick bay? Dr. Roster?
Diana, this is Buddy. Get down to Isolab 9 as fast as you can. And bring a portable vital sign indicator. David Fallon's inside the UFO and he's encased in some kind of gelatin.
There is no need to be frightened. Professor Mallon has not been harmed.
Alien Worlds will continue.
Sensation, a cool combination, chocolatey and mint.
Drop peppermint patty.
Oh, the sensation, a perfect relation, chocolatey and mint.
From Peter Paul.
Cool as the snow falling light on the trees. Just take a bite for a cool minty breeze.
Get your peppermint patty and get the sensation. Sensation, a cool combination, chocolatey and mint.
Your peppermint patty.
Cool the sensation, a perfect relation, chocolatey and mint.
From Peter Paul.
Send a shiver of cool right down to your knees. After one taste, you just gotta say please.
I want a York peppermint patty to get the sensation.
Your peppermint patty.
Get the sensation.
Alien Worlds continues. Entering the control booth of Isolab 9, Mora, Buddy, and John discover that the substance inside the alien decahedron has transformed itself into a duplicate of Professor David Ballin, leaving the real David Ballin encased in a cocoon of translucent white gelatin.
Tried to get into the chamber.
The hatch is sealed from the inside.
There's no need to be frightened, Dr. Rossiter. Professor Ballin has not been harmed.
He knows me.
He knows all of us, Diana.
Connect the vital sign indicator to the scanner terminal, John. Oh, he's all right. His vital signs are perfect.
Oh, boy. Well.
If you will be patient, the seed placenta will soon evaporate, and David will be released.
Soon? How long is soon?
Now.
David, are you all right?
I think so, yes. I suggest you leave the chamber now, David. The placenta residue will soon convert to a toxic gas that could mutate your senses. Yes, all right.
Hey, look at
home. Where have you been?
Oh. When that thing opened up last night and took me inside, I thought I was a goner. But as soon as the seed placenta started to cover me, I wasn't afraid anymore. It was incredible. I sensed everything that was going on. And when my duplicate emerged, it was like one of those films where the guy dies and you see his spirit leave his body.
Film, huh? I guess art imitates life after all.
I think it's the other way around, Skip.
Life and art should be the same.
Ah, yes, they should be. But they rarely are.
Perhaps we should learn the lesson of the Balinese. They say they have no art. They simply do everything as well as they can.
You once said that to me, David.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it, how precisely I've been duplicated.
Well, David number two... What now?
I want to return to my world, Diana. And I want to take Mara with me.
Now, hold on a minute, you. I'm not in the habit of running off to alien worlds with life forms I hardly know.
You know me, Mara. And I know you.
He's got a point there, Mara.
Well, be that as it may, I just don't think the original me and the duplicate you are ready for... Well, why are your hands transparent anyway?
David was wearing protective gloves that prevented the seed placenta from taking a precise imprint of his hands. And Mora, a duplicate of you is all I want.
Why?
I still love you, Mora.
Oh, David. Why didn't you... Wait a minute. What am I saying?
Oh, this is weird.
David?
Yes?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, David. I mean the duplicate David.
Yes, Diana.
I think all of us would like to know a little more about your origins.
Centuries ago, explorers from another galaxy visited my planet. Their bodies contained bacteria, harmless to them, but lethal to us. There was a plague. And before the end came, our scientists created the placenta substance and filled it with the genetic seeds that were the essence of our race. Then they placed these seeds of time in hundreds of vehicles like this one and set us adrift in the universe.
Was your race humanoid?
Yes, buddy, it was. But some of the cells were randomly coded so we could become whatever organic life form we contacted. I could have been a bird or an insect or even a flower. Any living thing in which the seeds could take root.
What would have happened if you had become a flower?
I would have simply pollinated other flowers of the same species. And my race would have been reborn as a genus of conscious, intelligent orchids or roses.
Would you eventually have re-evolved your original humanoid form?
Eventually, yes. But I'm not a flower, am I? I'm an ion-negative duplicate of a human male. And my race can be reborn only if I interact with an ion-positive duplicate of a human female.
All right, I'll do it.
Yes, my girl.
Thank you, Mara.
It's okay. Just remember, I don't fool around on the first date. What do you want me to do?
Saturate yourself with pure oxygen for 2 minutes. That will protect you from the toxic residue. Then come into the chamber and enter the secondary placenta compartment of my vehicle.
Okay. Get me an E4 oxygen unit, buddy. I'm about to become a double feature.
Okay.
How do you feel, Mara?
I'll be all right, Diana.
I'll be all right, Diana.
Listen to that. I'm in stereo.
Thank you, Mara. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes?
When you and David... this David, are, you know, when you're, will I feel anything?
We don't know, Mara. It's possible.
Hmm.
You'd better leave the chamber now, Mara. The placenta residue is starting to become toxic.
All right. Bye.
Goodbye, Mara.
Did you arrange for a ship, John?
There's a long-range shuttle waiting for them just outside the airlock.
Mara, you'll be able to fly the shuttle, won't you?
Yes. I love the rockets as much as you do now.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Well, so long, you two.
Mara.
Good luck.
It looks like we're getting that second chance after all, Mara.
You're right, David. Absolutely right.
Seeds of Time was written by Ron Thompson and starred Linda Gary, Chuck Olson, Bruce Philip Miller, and Corey Burton, with special guest stars Pete Renaday and Francis Bay. Associate producer Ron Thompson, music director Tom Rounds, engineer Stu Jacobs, technical consultant Peter Skye, assistant to the producer Jim Cook. Alien Worlds was created, produced, and directed by Lee Hansen and is distributed by Watermark Incorporated. And so, until next week, this is Roger Dressler from the Elsewhere and Elsewhen of Alien Worlds.
Truth is stranger than fiction. And this is the proof. This is Ripley's Believe It or Not.
A witch doctor in Angola, Africa, who wants to resign his profession, must attain an entirely new identity by wearing a mask day and night for a whole year, believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you the weird story of a man who staged his own execution.
are listening to night transmissions. I don't want to alarm you, but there is more to come. Some men have been known to do strange things in the face of death, and Giuseppe Caracci certainly was one of them. Giuseppe was an Italian sculptor who was sentenced to death in Paris for attempting to murder Napoleon. He persuaded authorities to permit him to travel to the guillotine in the purple robes of a Roman emperor, and he rode in a golden coach which he designed especially for his own execution, believe it or not.
Finally, tonight is an episode of
Murder at Midnight.
Now, I know that it's more than possible that I have mentioned how much I like that opening.
Murder at Midnight.
In fact, it's probably the best thing about the program in my estimation. This show, which was produced in New York by the radio station WJZ, began its run on September the 16th of 1946 and would remain in production until September the 8th of 1947. It was syndicated nationally by the Mutual Network and hosted by Raymond Morgan, who is the guy responsible for the introduction that I played enough times already today, I think. I've grown to really love Murder at Midnight. It's certainly not the best radio show I ever produced. But it's not really a guilty pleasure either. You know, one of those things so bad that it's fun. Oh, I know the show could be silly at times. But it has achieved the grace of being camp. And I mean really camp. Not like some stuff, you know, in the last several years that has produced with the idea that it is camp. In fact, I don't see how that works. I don't see how you can produce anything to be camp. It becomes camp. It achieves a patina of camp. You can't manufacture camp. Camp is always inadvertent. One of the things you might notice as you listen to some of these shows is that they have a familiar ring about them. Well, it's a good reason for that. One of the ways Murder at Midnight kept costs down was to reproduce scripts that originally aired elsewhere, pretty much entirely on Inner Sanctum. This, beyond just a frugal measure, did allow Murder at Midnight to produce scripts by some of the best writing talent working in radio, and so that can't be all bad. It is chintzy, though, isn't it? One of the ways Murder at Midnight distinguished itself from its sister program, Inner Sanctum, was pure attitude, even when sometimes doing the same scripts. Murder at Midnight brings a far more noir atmosphere to its presentation. It's a far more hard-boiled approach to the supernatural. Raymond Chandler in the graveyard. All that's left for me now to say is, this is Murder at Midnight, with the episode Island of the Dead, which originally aired on December the 20th of 1946.
Murder!
You're lying, Donner. You know you're lying. And you know it won't do you any good, because this time I'm going to pass judgment myself. 15 years seeing about it, dreaming about it. My fingers around throat, digging into that flabby windpipe of yours. Tighter, tighter, till you stop struggling, Ed. And now I've got a nice grave all ready and waiting for you, right next to your friend.
Murder at Midnight.
three graves yawning on a lonely, fog-bound island, waiting for whom? You'll learn the answer in just a moment in tonight's story, The Island of the Dead. And now our story, The Island of the Dead, an original radio play by one of radio's best-known mystery writers, Robert Newman, a story of a dead man who came back. It's a small island, flat and barren, lying in the middle of the river, and it's truly an island of the dead, for it's a city's potter's field. It's here that nameless dead are buried. Those who have no relatives claim them. Those who are too poor to pay for burial elsewhere. At one end of the island, here, where the city launch docks. At the other end of the island, amidst shallow graves, squat stone building where the watchman lives. It's 11:30 at night now. He's sitting in the office, reading a paper, and listening to the river sounds when...
Who's there? Who's that?
I said, who's there?
Who the devil are you? What do you want?
I think it's where I suppose come.
What do you mean? Hey, wait a minute. Are you the new relief man?
My name is Simon.
I'm Hallity. From now on, lay off that stuff, will you? This place is bad enough without you spooking around, not answering when someone talks to you.
Bad?
The crying bells, you know what the job is, don't you? Receiving the stiffs that they send out, keeping the records and digging the graves. You'd be all alone, except Joe, the guy that runs the launch at the other end of the island. He only comes out when he has to.
Yes, no.
Well, I'll go change shirt and blow. I didn't think they were going to be able to get a relief man until next week. I'm sure glad you got out here tonight. This was really starting to get me down. And I'll be out in a couple of minutes. Simon, where are you?
Over here.
Know where the blaze had gone. What in thunder are you doing?
Digging some graves.
I see that. Three of them. What for?
Because it'll be needed before the night over.
Huh? You mean they called up and told you to get them ready? It's funny. I didn't hear the phone.
No, no one phoned.
Well, then why are you doing it?
I told you. I think they'll be needed.
You think? Look, I'm going right now. I'll be back tomorrow night, unless I decide not to come back at all.
Wait a minute, Harity. I don't get it. Who are you talking about? And when did I see him?
The new relief man. Just came out about a half hour ago. You must have seen him. This is the only way you can get out to the island.
That's why I don't get it. If anybody did come out to the island, I'd be bound to. But no one did. Not tonight.
What do you mean?
I mean, I only made one trip out to it. I didn't have no passengers. Snap lag. All I brought out was stiff.
Marsh?
Yes, speaking.
Mr. Alec Marsh, attorney.
Attorney? Well, I hear one. I haven't practiced law in over 10 years. Who's this?
This is the watch for City Cemetery out on Channel Island. I'd appreciate it very much to come out immediately.
Come out there? The night? What for?
To identify a body.
What? What makes you think I can identify it?
I have reason to believe you are one of the people who can identify it. It's quite urgent. If you take the launch, Ripley, I'll meet you at this end. Will you do it?
Don't know. Funny business. All right, I'll leave right away.
Is it much further to the island?
Nope, you can't see it because of the fog, but it's just right ahead.
Is something new, people to go out to the island to identify bodies? Don't they usually do it down at the morgue?
Yeah, mostly, but once in a while it gets dope after the body's been done.
Well, I don't like it. Part of getting a man out in the middle of the night, especially with a river like this, not being able to see anything, goes in the foghorn. And then landing there on the island where... Oh, sense I'd go right back with you, not go ashore at all.
Well, here we are. Just let me make a fast. Okay. Well, we getting off?
I don't know. I'll tell you what. The man that phoned said he'd... I'll go up to the end of the dock. He's not there. I'll
come. Okay.
Mr. Marsh?
Yes? Was it you who phoned me?
Yes, follow me, please.
How the dickens can you see where you're going when it's so dark?
You get used to it, just as you get used to anything. As a matter of fact, probably just as well it is dark.
Why? Couldn't be worse even in daylight when you can see the graves. How did you happen to call me on this business anyway?
I told you, because you're one of the very few people can be of any help. Weren't you the attorney for the defense in the Sloan case?
Sloan? Sloan? I can't remember. Simon Sloan.
Yes.
I'm not sure. If I was, it was a long time ago.
More than 15 years. But execution, remember?
Yes, yes, I think I was. Convicted on a charge of murder in the second degree and got 20 years. Time off for good behavior. He's probably out now and... Wait a minute. Is that you want to identify? Is he dead?
Here we are. Watch step going in.
Well, what are you waiting for? Aren't you going to put on the light?
No, not yet.
What was that? The door. You locked the door. What's the idea? What are you trying to do?
That's just so we won't stir.
Stir? Well, who's going to disturb us? I insist you put on the light. Open that door immediately.
We were talking about Sloan. You admitted to the attorney, Fence. Do you feel you did a good job of ending him?
How do I know? How do you expect me to remember? The fact that Vic doesn't mean that it's my fault. Besides, what's that got to do?
You think that...
How do I know what I thought? What difference does it make? He pleaded guilty.
He wasn't guilty. He didn't want to plead. Who made him plead?
I did, so what?
Very well. There.
Where is... You. It's you. You're Simon Sloan.
The dead man, the island dead, three waiting graves. As the clock moves steadily towards the witching hour, prepare yourself for murder at midnight. Now, to go on, story of Island the Dead. It's just a moment later. There is silence. Small, bare rooms. Marsh stares. Strange figure that stands opposite him slowly. His face pale, drawn.
You shouldn't have done this to me. I told you I'm not well. I've got a bad heart.
Why did you do it? Why did you, Michael?
I had to.
Why?
Because Donna, the district attorney, made me. He wanted the conviction to build up his record. And he had something on me. An attempted bribery in another case. What are you going to do to me? I've got to get away from here. I'm a sick man, I tell you.
I'm not going to do it. You can go now, if you can. There. The door's open.
Why are you looking at me like that? You think I can't make it, don't you? And that's why you're letting me go. Well, I'll show you. I'll show you. I just have to take it easy and...
No, I didn't think you would. That is why I'm not angry at you. Now I have a place for you. Right outside here. For you and for some other.
Hello?
Mr. Donner?
Yes, who's this?
It is the watchman at City Cemetery out on Channel Island. We have a body out here that very much like to look at.
A body? What for?
We think that possibly you may be able to identify it.
And what makes you think that?
Well, after all, you were district attorney for several years.
What? Why, I haven't been DA for... What's that got to do with it?
It may have a great deal to do with it. Will you come? The launch leaves from the foot of River Street.
Yes, I know. Something very strange about this, but all right, I'll come. Will there be someone to meet me at the other end?
Yes, Mr. Donner. I'll meet you. I'll be waiting for you.
Usual to have someone try and identify a body when it's already in a grave?
No, it's very unusual. But this is a rather special case. I'm sorry I have any flashlight candle. There.
Good Lord.
You do know him?
Yes, I know him. His name is Marsh, Alec Marsh. He was disbarred about 10 years ago. When did I?
About an hour ago.
But that's possible. He couldn't have gotten you quick.
Not if dead. But when he came here, he's still alive.
I don't understand. Why should he have come out here in the first place?
Because I phoned him. I asked him out. Just as I asked you to come out. You see, I want to talk to him about Simon Sloan.
This Sloan case, but what? How? Wait a minute. Lift that candle up. You're Sloan.
I'm Sloan. What's left of him? You're the man who said me. You knew I wasn't.
You can't blame me for that. After all, it was my job to prosecute. When I did find out the truth.
Find it out?
When I did, it was too late. You'd already been convicted. Stand up, and I've got to get away from here. Let me go, you.
No. There are two more at the point. What did you find out here?
The detective in the case told me. A chap named Richards. Bill Richards.
When you found out the truth, they've ordered a trial and gotten me out. You let me stay. What?
No, I couldn't. It was just Richard word. He said he wouldn't testify.
You're lying, Donna. You know you're lying. You know it won't do any good this time. I'm going to pay myself. Dreaming of my thing round you into that lab windpipe of yours. Tighter, tighter. Stop struggling and... Now I've got a nice grave all ready and waiting for you here, right to Marsh. And one more for our friend.
Yes,
when we get out?
Yes. Now, you wait right here for us, Joe.
I've seen it to you, Hardy, I will. You sure have had my belly full. What a night.
Now, look who's talking. Me, I've got to go traipsing all over this bloody island because your friend here comes in the station house with a story nobody believe except the captain.
For crying bells, Richards. You think I made it up? What about those two other guys Joe said he brought out here? What about those three graves this guy Simon digging?
Well, where are they? Did you dream them up, too?
I didn't dream anything up, Richard. They're right over here.
They do look like graves. I got a match your place. Take a look at them.
Lord, there's a body. This one here, too.
I see them. This one here looks like... What is Marsh? Alec Marsh. And that's John Donner.
Now am I crazy? Now was I making things up?
Shut up. This guy that came out here, said his name was Simon?
Yes.
He must be about 55 now. Probably looks older. Tall, thin face, gray hair.
That's right, that's him. Do you know him?
Yeah, I know him. Look, I was ribbing you before, but he's a danger killer. I'm going to stay here and try and find him. I'll probably need help. You and Joe take the launch back to shore, get hold of the captain, and have him send out 3 or 4 more men. Fast.
Okay, Richard, right away.
Sloan! Where are you? I know it's you, and you know you can't get away. That building. Went in there, huh? Won't have gone. So see. Stick him up, Sloan. I'll let you have it. Reach, you hear me?
Yes, Rick. I hear.
Put on the light.
There isn't any light in it, but I've got a candle.
So, it really is you. I heard you were out of stir, and I was sure it was as soon as I saw Marsh and Donner out there. You killed them, didn't you?
Yes, I...
Really funny. I'd like to hear someone now say there isn't a thing of fate.
It is funny. I tried to get you on the phone just the way I did Marsh and Donner. But of course I... Then you come out here on your own.
Thought you'd get me too, huh? Well, that's okay. I'd try to get you, and I would have. The jury hadn't gone so panty-waist and given you just 20 years. You know that it was...
Yes, I know it. I just don't know why.
Why? Because I've always hated you. I was just a flatfoot and you were a gambler, pulling in big dough. I never could touch you on the level. That's why I hated you. That's why I framed you, no? I didn't get you then 15 years ago, but I've got you now.
Have you, Richard? I guess maybe you ought to look around, see where we are.
What do you mean?
We're in the room where they keep stiffs till they're buried. Kind of an icebox. And if you'll notice, there's no handle on the side of the door. That means no way out.
What? Why, you... So what? Someone will be along sooner or later.
Oh, when anyone does, it'll be late. Because that door is airtight. That means soon as we're up here and here now, we're finished. Both of us. And it started bad already.
I mean, you trapped me. You got me in here deliberately. Well, you won't get away with it.
No good. That won't. Not any more than I'm hurt. All you see, I'm all gone, side. That's why it released me. I must pass out the street last night, and my heart was bad. He thought I'd slip me out here for burial, and I was dead. I couldn't die until I evened up. Waited to shore. Now I've done it. Gotten all three of you.
No. There must be some way out. Some... This smoke. I can't breathe.
Way out. Ken, that's our line. When that's out, the finish. Starting. Turned already.
Help. Help. Somebody, please.
There's no help, Fritz. This it. There. The can's gone out. You might as well lie down and get quiet like me. There's just one. I own dug 3 graves for the 3 of you. Now, someone else will have to. Mine.
And so, as gasping bodies drop to the floor, the mission of Simon Sloan is completed. First Marsh, then Donner, and finally Richard succumb to...
Murder at midnight.
Remember to be with us again when death stalks the wicked as the clock strike 12 for...
Murder at midnight!
Well, we've got a few minutes left, so I thought I would go ahead and bring in a little Dick. Philip K. Dick, I mean. From Science Fiction Stories, sometime in 1953, is The Eyes Have It.
The Eyes Have It. By Philip K. Dick. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Greg Marguerite. The Eyes Have It by Philip K. Dick. It was quite by accident I discovered this incredible invasion of Earth by life forms from another planet. As yet, I haven't done anything about it. I can't think of anything to do. I wrote to the government, and they sent back a pamphlet on the repair and maintenance of frame houses. Anyhow, the whole thing is known. I'm not the first to discover it. Maybe it's even under control. I was sitting in my easy chair, idly turning the pages of a paperbacked book someone had left on the bus when I came across the reference that first put me on the trail. For a moment, I didn't respond. It took some time for the full import to sink in. After I'd comprehended, it seemed odd. I hadn't noticed it right away. The reference was clearly to a non-human species of incredible properties, not indigenous to Earth. A species, I hasten to point out, customarily masquerading as ordinary human beings. Their disguise, however, became transparent in the face of the following observations by the author. It was at once obvious the author knew everything, and was taking it in his stride. The line, and I tremble, remembering it even now, read, "His eyes slowly roved about the room. Vague chills assailed me. I tried to picture the eyes. Did they roll like dimes? The passage indicated not. They seemed to move through the air, not over the surface. Rather rapidly, apparently. No one in the story was surprised. That's what tipped me off. No sign of amazement at such an outrageous thing. Later, the matter was amplified. His eyes moved from person to person." There it was in a nutshell. The eyes had clearly come apart from the rest of him and were on their own. My heart pounded and my breath choked in my windpipe. I had stumbled on an accidental mention of a totally unfamiliar race. Obviously non-terrestrial. Yet, to the characters in the book, it was perfectly natural, which suggested they belonged to the same species. A slow suspicion burned in my mind. The author was taking it rather too easily in his stride. Evidently, he felt this was quite a usual thing. He made absolutely no attempt to conceal this knowledge. The story continued. Presently, his eyes fastened on Julia. Julia, being a lady, had at least the breeding to feel indignant. She is described as blushing and knitting her brows angrily. At this, I sighed with relief. They weren't all non-terrestrials. The narrative continues. Slowly, calmly, his eyes examined every inch of her. Great Scott! But here the girl turned and stomped off, and the matter ended. I lay back in my chair, gasping with horror. My wife and family regarded me in wonder. "What's wrong, dear?" my wife asked. I couldn't tell her. Knowledge like this was too much for the ordinary run-of-the-mill person. I had to keep it to myself. "Nothing," I gasped. I leaped up, snatched the book, and hurried out of the room. In the garage, I continued reading. There was more. Trembling, I read the next revealing passage. He put his arm around Julia. Presently, she asked him if he would remove his arm. He immediately did so, with a smile. It's not said what was done with the arm after the fellow had removed it. Maybe it was left standing upright in the corner. Maybe it was thrown away. I don't care. In any case, the full meaning was there, staring me right in the face. Here was a race of creatures capable of removing portions of their anatomy at will. Eyes, arms, and maybe more. Without batting an eyelash. My knowledge of biology came in handy at this point. Obviously, they were simple beings, unicellular, some sort of primitive single-celled things. Beings no more developed than starfish. Starfish can do the same thing, you know. I read on and came to this incredible revelation, tossed off coolly by the author without the faintest tremor. Outside the movie theater, we split up. Part of us went inside, part over to the cafe for dinner. Binary fission, obviously. Splitting in half and forming two entities. Probably each lower half went to the cafe, it being farther, and the upper halves to the movies. I read on, hands shaking. I had really stumbled onto something here. My mind reeled as I made out this passage. I'm afraid there's no doubt about it. Poor Bibney has lost his head again. Which was followed by, "And Bob says he has utterly no guts." Yet Bibney got around as well as the next person. The next person, however, was just as strange. He was soon described as totally lacking in brains. There was no doubt of the thing in the next passage. Julia, whom I'd had thought to be the one normal person, reveals herself as also being an alien life form, similar to the rest. Quite deliberately, Julia had given her heart to the young man. It didn't relate what the final disposition of the organ was, but I didn't really care. It was evident Julia had gone right on living in her usual manner, like all the others in the book, without heart, arms, eyes, brains, viscera, dividing up in two when the occasion demanded, without a qualm. Thereupon she gave him her hand. I sickened. The rascal now had her hand as well as her heart. I shudder to think what he's done with them by this time. He took her arm. Not content to wait, he had started dismantling her on his own. Flushing crimson, I slammed the book shut and leapt to my feet, but not in time to escape one last reference to those carefree bits of anatomy whose travels had originally thrown me on the track. Her eyes followed him all the way down the road and across the meadow. I rushed from the garage and back inside the warm house, as if the accursed thing were following me. My wife and children were playing Monopoly in the kitchen. I joined them and played with frantic fervor, brow feverish, teeth chattering. I had had enough of the thing. I wanted to hear no more about it. Let them come on. Let them invade Earth. I don't want to get mixed up in it. I have absolutely no stomach for it. End of The Eyes Have It by Philip K. Dick.
Well, I think that's about it for today. You might want to, if you have a little time, go on by the website. That's www.nighttransmissions, one word, no space between the night and the transmissions.com, where for this program there is some extra material. Don't think of it as homework, it's just extra material. For one thing, both the Philip K. Dick story and the Shirley Jackson story I'm in the public domain, so I'm able to provide links for both of those. There's also, for the lottery, a very nicely done presentation from the New Yorker with Gene Stapleton reading the text. Also, at the website, there's a page for each show, and on each page there's an area for comments, where you can make comments, I guess. Well, you can say anything you want, really. And there's a general comments page where you can tell me off or give me suggestions. I'd really like some suggestions. Not that you have to go to the webpage to write me. You can write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. You know, there's even a G-voice number here where people could leave comments. That doesn't get much use. And I hardly ever mention it. But be warned, if you do leave a message there, I might just put it on the program. You never know. Anyway, the number there is 541-995-0594. You don't need to write that down or anything. It's actually on the webpage. You just go to the contact section and it'll be right there, along with all of this other stuff I've been prattling on about. Final note, I promise I'll leave you alone real soon. From the Edison recordings in 1901, Silas Leachman singing Fortune-Telling Man.
That fortune-telling man sung by Silas Leachman. Till it is no use in talking, I've got 'em faded on telling the past, the present, and the future. Man coming across the water. That's what he is. In an old big house, just as quiet as a mouse, I sit and occasionally read about old Mars. And in the dead of night, without a speck of light, I have gathered through the window all the stars. In early in the morning, just before the break of dawn,
our kids want a little rest and that I can. Gale, I must be up, you see, meeting folks what come to me. They all come to see that fortune killing man. I am the fortune killing man. There's no kind of dream that I can understand. I can tell your future by looking in your hand. I am that fortune telling man. The very next night, just before I lit the light, a monstrous looking coon came to my door. He said he'd had a dream, an awful thing he'd seen. A spirit dressed in white walk across the blue. I looked into his hand, and I said, see ya, young man, that dream and both your hands, they were a veil. I could read his great surprise as a telescoped his eyes when I said, you'll marry quick or go to jail. I am dead fortune telling a man. Dog, no kind of dream that I can't understand. I can tell you future by reading in your hand. I am a dead fortune telling man. No use in talking, I've got 'em all faded when I'm looking into the gloomy past. Yeah.